Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us. You are listening to Latin Ways. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. I am delighted to be joined by Sandra Koff. She is an amazing freelance journalist based in Guatemala. Originally from Vancouver, she has lived in Central America for 15 of the past 20 years. Her work has been published by Al Jazeera, LA Times, The Guardian, The Intercept, Mongabe, and Washington Post, The New Humanitarian, and many other outlets. She is an amazing journalist. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for the kind words.
Now, Sandra, in your work, you cover human rights, politics, social movements, migration, environmental issues, and you bring to life stories that would have otherwise, you know, disappeared from, you know, in the inundation of trauma we have in our world. And so I want to begin by talking about your recent coverage of the indigenous survivors pursuing justice at a genocide trial in Guatemala. Can you share for our audience about how the events that took place have shaped this trial, and you know, how did it unfold? Why was this important for you to cover?
Sure. So in Guatemala, there was a 36-year civil war between 1960 and 1996, and an estimated or more than 200,000 people were killed. 45,000 people were disappeared, and truth commissions have established that state forces, military and paramilitary forces, were responsible for more than 90% of atrocities, and that indigenous Mayans, mostly civilians, were about more than 80% of the victims. So the worst atrocities during the war were between 1981 and 1983. Mm. And so this trial and other trials that have happened and that are sort of slated to happen, the reason those got started was really because of survivors. So survivors of genocide, of massacres, of disappearances, of sexual violence, which was used as sort of a weapon of war, they organized and formed an association, so the Association for Justice and Reconciliation, which is sort of an umbrella organization of survivors from the five indigenous regions in Guatemala that were worst hit. A UN-backed truth commission established that genocide occurred during these years. So they're the ones that initially filed like official complaints with prosecutors against the two governments that were in power between those years where genocide occurred. So the first government was Romeo Lucas Garcia, and the second was Efrain Rios Montt. So that first government, that head of state, died in 2006. So the official complaint that survivors presented was in the year 2000. So we're talking about 24 years later, this case is finally going to trial. So the head of state died in 2006. There were initially three people who were supposed to be tried in the genocide case. The one who is on trial is Benedicto Lucas Garcia, who is the brother of the president, and he was the chief of the general staff of the army between 1981 and 1982. There were two others. One died in 2020, and the other one earlier this year was declared mentally unfit to stand trial, so he'll face separate proceedings in absentia. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's this trial. There have been, you know, many other trials for massacres, another one for genocide, enforced disappearances. But I think one of the really important things to understand about all these cases is that really it's the survivors and the relatives of victims and the organizations and lawyers that support them who have been really driving this whole process to get these cases actually to trial. So in this case, it's a case regarding a specific region, the Maya Ishil region, but that's because that was what was determined to be the strongest case. So it's not to say that there wasn't genocide during those years in other regions, and survivors from other regions have been among those organizing, you know, to get this case to trial. They're accompanying it. They're there in the courtroom, and they actually have official standing as joint plaintiffs alongside the prosecutors. So their lawyers can intervene sort of as joint prosecutors throughout the whole trial.
We live in an anti-Indigenous world, you know, in a way. There have been many genocides, but some genocides are so silent. And we're numbed, you know, by the immensity of constant aggression and violence faced by Indigenous people. You mentioned that there were over 45,000 people disappear. You mentioned that this is a trial of genocide. You mentioned that the person being trialed, Lucas Garcia, is the brother of the president. I mean, states are unlikely to prosecute themselves. So can you speak to the difficulty of prosecuting these trials despite the overwhelming evidence?
I mean, there are relatively few genocide prosecutions of high-ranking officials or heads of state in the domestic courts of their own countries, right? So, you know, there have been international tribunals that have heard cases of genocide in other countries around the world. Guatemala is a relatively rare case. So there are many factors that probably play into these cases actually going to trial. Obviously, the end of the armed conflict, the peace accords, truth commissions, there have been decades of exhumations of clandestine graves, of massacre sites, which obviously produces a lot of evidence. You know, there's been decades of movements by survivors and lawyers and organizations to dig into the military documents that can help establish the intent, because Lucas Garcia, who's head of the army, is also being charged with crimes against humanity, which can be the actual events that took place. But for genocide, you have to prove that that person had the intent to kill a group in whole or in part, because of, in this case, their ethnicity. So, I mean, genocide cases are very complicated, but these cases were advanced by prosecutors under a previous attorney general who was much more active and willing to pursue these cases and corruption cases against extremely high-ranking individuals of the past and present in Guatemala. There were also some judges at the helm of these sort of major crimes or high-risk courts who were also willing to hear the cases independently and sent some of them to trial, including this one. Those conditions have now changed in terms of, let's say, political will on behalf of the attorney general, some of the prosecutors, some of the judges, many of them gone into exile. But these cases preceded that, so they moved to trial before the conditions have changed. Sort of, there's no, you know, magic to these cases going to trial. You know, there's a lot of international attention, a lot of forensic evidence. At the time, you had judges and prosecutors and an attorney general who were really willing to go after these extremely major cases, including genocide. And, you know, it's not that there hasn't been major backlash and pushback that entire time, but some of these cases, like the present one, did manage to make it to trial.
In your article, you point out, you quote, a United Nations-backed Truth Commission found that the military committee acts of genocide. Five of the country's 22 different Maya people between 1981 and 1983. It is estimated that 200,000 people were murdered, with 80% of them being Mayan ancestry. That speaks to me to a very, you know, pointed targeting. Other victims included union members, clergy, student movements, and other groups. You know, most people in Western countries imagine that there are places in the world that are just naturally violent. There are just places in other places where, you know, crimes get committed because that's just how they are, right? Racist views about how this unfolds. Can you talk a little bit about the connection between the murderous actions that were taken against indigenous people and the displacement that occur from their lands and the connection perhaps to neoliberal ideology and the connection that displaces us from being a community to pitting people against fronts, right? Indigenous people versus other people.
Sure. I mean, in the case of Guatemala, I think it's important to look at the history. So very briefly, in 1944, Guatemala, there was the first democratically elected president. There was another one after that. That sort of started to, it's known as, you know, Guatemala's decade of spring. So labor rights, union rights, land reform, et cetera. And that was cut short by a coup in 1954 that was U.S.-backed. So that's sort of the precursor to the armed conflict because different left-wing and guerrilla forces emerged over the decades. And so in the 80s, the military essentially equated indigenous and their populations in certain regions with either guerrilla supporters or potential guerrilla members. But it was very targeted, especially in these certain regions. You know, that's not to say that in the capital and other parts of the country, sort of individuals weren't being targeted and disappeared and killed, union leaders, activists, et cetera, clergy as well. But in these regions, essentially everyone was seen as a potential guerrilla member. And these are indigenous regions, overwhelmingly indigenous regions. So that's somewhat what's behind it. And then, you know, you have extremely historic, you know, marginalization, discrimination, lack of rights that go back hundreds of years. And close to, not quite, but close to half of Guatemala's population is indigenous. And during those years, definitely indigenous populations were explicitly seen as internal enemies. This is, of course, during the more global context of the Cold War, the U.S. supporting counterinsurgency in Latin America.
Can you speak to the power of the social movements in this region, not only in bringing to the public these acts for justice, these calls for justice, but to the courage that it takes to remember, you know? It's like there's such woundedness, and yet in order for us to heal, we have to face that those atrocities have happened, and bringing them to justice has also an aspect of helping us not only unlearn violence as a colonial process that we have been indoctrinated with, but also to perhaps develop new tools for justice.
So, I mean, the movements in Guatemala are extremely strong. And also, you know, some of these organizations that represent survivors and relatives of victims, for example, in cases of enforced disappearances, some of the organizations that are sort of leading human rights organizations in the country, they formed in the 1980s. So while, you know, almost the worst of these atrocities were still going on. So this has sort of been a constant for decades, like since displacement and massacres and disappearances were going on, very shortly after some of these survivors organizations formed. And, you know, alongside that and also targeted around the same time, there were extremely strong land rights organizations, some of which still exist today that are majority indigenous. You also have traditional indigenous authorities, so sort of governance structures that are totally autonomous from municipal or national governance structures. And some of those have been taking more of a center stage. Last year, there was a mass movement against a sort of potential slogan coup to overturn election results. and Indigenous movements and traditional Indigenous authorities were at the forefront of that movement. Survivors movements were also accompanying that movement. You know, there were at one point more than 100 highways and roads blockaded, 105 days people were outside the prosecutor's office here in Guatemala City. Yeah, there's very powerful Indigenous movements in Guatemala that have been around for decades. And I think maybe more recently, there's been more recognition and support among others in Guatemala, and including the capital. Yeah, they really point to a shift in terms of non-Indigenous people and people in the capital of recognizing the leadership of Indigenous authorities and organizations in sort of the broader social movement in the country.
What inspires you to be immersed in this pursuit of justice? What inspires you to not only ally, but also be engaged in such a meaningful way in a road for social justice and to pursue these trials, which may seem, you know, to many, you know, this is the government, this is the brother of the president, where is it going to go? And yet to know that, you know, to do the right thing, to take action towards justice is always the right thing to do.
I knew at a relatively early age, and I really don't remember what inspired me, but I was extremely interested in human rights and very interested in Central America. So I came down initially and I did human rights accompaniment. I worked for a small human rights organization more than 20 years ago. And I shifted to journalism in, you know, a bit over a decade ago. So I really don't remember what the initial spark was, but I lived in Honduras for many years and now here. Yeah, and I think that Guatemala did have a major genocide trial in 2013. And so the military ruler who actually overthrew the Lupus Garcia brothers, he stood trial for genocide. He was convicted. It was overturned. He died before the partial trial ended. And that got a lot of international attention. But I think all these other cases that are going on are extremely important. I mean, particularly in Guatemala. Yeah, to be covering, I mean, these are the stories of the family members of people who were killed. These are the stories of, you know, there's going to be more than 30 witnesses in this trial who suffered sexual violence during that time. You know, there's children of people who were killed who are following the trial and are part of these organizations that push for it. So, yeah, I think it's a really important trial to follow, as are many other crimes against humanity trials that are, you know, going on at different stages here in Guatemala. You know, that's not to say that current human rights abuses aren't also important to follow, but a genocide trial is quite a rare thing. So that's why I'm hoping to be covering this one.
When I think about the 80s and growing up in Latin America, I remember, you know, the bodies on the streets. And there's something to grieve a family member who has been murdered. The pain of never having closure, of knowing whether your person is alive or still being tortured, you know, and the finding of these mass graves just rewounds the spirit in such a way. And so I wonder if you could talk about the importance of having justice for the families. We're always talking about reconciliation in Canada now with the finding of mass of graves of children being, you know, murdered at residential schools. And so to me, the connection between realizing the importance of finding justice, because when we find a way to act in order to attain justice for one group, it also expands our vision for justice in other places in the world. And so maybe if you could talk about why is it important for us to not only collaborate together, you know, organize together and pursue and support groups who are pursuing justice.
So, I mean, there's a couple things there because, you know, as you mentioned, there's a lot of people who don't know what happened to their family members or, you know, friends or coworkers. And so that is an intertwined That justice for that isn't only trial. So there have been cases here for enforced disappearance. Benedicto Lucas Garcia, who's currently on trial for genocide and crimes against humanity, he was convicted in another case of enforced disappearance. And he's also one of the accused in one of the biggest cases in Latin America of mass graves, where the remains of more than 560 people were exhumed from a military base here. So in terms of justice, one thing is trials, but for relatives of the disappeared, one of the bigger aspects for many people is knowing what happened to their relatives, like you mentioned. So that has happened in many cases of exhumation, but in many cases, they still don't know what happened. So other cases that are going to trial of enforced disappearance, you know, it's one of the main things that people want to know. It's really important here for most people that, you know, they're able to give a proper burial to their relative, that they're able to know where they are, know what happened, have somewhere to go to honor them. And that doesn't necessarily come out of trial. So people can be convicted for enforced disappearance without necessarily people knowing what happened to their relatives, which for some people is more important than a conviction. When it comes to the disappeared, I mean, that's essentially, it's an ongoing crime that never ends until the person is found. So that in some ways, it's more present because it's ongoing. Compared to, say, you know, other killings where the family knows what happened to the person, they were buried, they have somewhere to go to honor that that person. So, I mean, yeah, I think one of the things, you know, about this trial and other trials is that sort of regardless of what happened in different regions or to different families, you know, whether they're part of an organization that's relatives of the disappeared, whether they're part of one of the organizations, Society for Justice for Massacres, or one of the organizations representing genocide survivors in a certain region, as well as other human rights organizations that, you know, aren't made up of survivors and relatives, everybody's come together to support the people in this trial. You know, when it was supposed to open, there was a ceremony. The Ishil authorities were there, people who, you know, as children, witnessed massacres in totally other regions that are not part of this trial were there. And so there's a significant amount of support between all these different movements and organizations here, which is really important. There's also international organizations that to some degree provide accompaniment and support and trial observation. But yeah, that there are international solidarity and accompaniment organizations who have been, you know, showing up at the trial, who have accompanied witnesses, et cetera. Obviously, the protagonists are the survivors and relatives of victims here. But there is a lot of support and solidarity, and I think that's been really important as well.
Thank you so much for your work, not only on this trial, but in all your journalistic efforts to bring to light, you know, many atrocities, be it, you know, the displacement of indigenous people to allow for mining rights to, you know, destroy land, but also for inviting us to remember, we have power, you know, and we have power when we act collectively. How can people get in touch with your work? How can people read your articles?
So my work, most of it I post, I have a website, which is just my name, sandracuff.com. And that's also my, you can find me on Twitter with the same name. So yeah. Google searching my name will come up with my website, and the rest of my work can be found there.
And if you were to offer our audience a call to action, what would that be?
I'm not necessarily in a position to be voicing calls to action on my behalf, but definitely the Organization of Survivors, the Association of Justice and Reconciliation, which is being accompanied by the Archbishop's Office of Human Rights, They have made an international call to people, human rights organizations, others, to follow this trial, to observe it. It's being transmitted online. Verdad y Justicia is a Twitter and Facebook account people can find if they want to actually watch the proceedings live. But yeah, those organizations that are directly involved and directly affected have called for people to pay attention, to actually come and observe the trial if they can, or just to follow it in the hopes that that will help ensure judicial independence in this case, that maybe the trial and, you know, verdict can actually go forward fairly based on all the evidence that's being presented. So that's their call that they made public right before the trial started. That was their international call.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an independently produced syndicated radio program made available for free to campus and community radios, and also to the world at latinwavesmedia.com. Please visit the website to hear previous shows, hear about upcoming events, and consider becoming a member for as little as $1 per month.